All right, hi everybody, and welcome to the test 3, test preparation class for the elementary group in the ancient history program of History at Our House. We're going to do the test on archaic Greece coming up here, especially Athens and Sparta, of course. So you have had your test preparation sheets for a few days now. You've been working on them, and now it's your opportunity to test the work that you've done and get my feedback on it. So I'm going to share my screen with you guys, and we're going to go back and forth between the various tests. The lower L is shorter and has fewer questions, and the upper L has more complicated questions, but that way you can kind of compare a little bit as we're doing this. We'll go back and forth. Some of them, of course, are the same, but we'll just go back and forth in this test prep exercise. So let's go ahead and get started. This is lower L here. Let's go ahead and get started with the anchor fact timeline facts. Quite a few of these we were able to review as part of our in-class discussions. We didn't quite get back to this archaic storyline over here in the brown and the purple, but that was your job to go back and see what kind of material you had to help you with that. So let's go see how you did. And let's start with number one, which if it's the same on the upper L, anybody can kind of raise their hand on number one here. Okay, so Patrick's going to get started on the lower L. Go ahead, sir.
We are here because of the discovery of America. I mean, like, we wouldn't be here if there was no America.
I see, right. Okay, so the we are here, of course, 2015-16, is the essence of number one. And what I would suggest that you put on an answer like that would be, this is where we are studying ancient history. Something kind of more like that. The part about the discovery of America is true, that we wouldn't be here without it, but that has to do more with this fact over here, right, which is not labeled. So I think that it's a good idea to shoot for a little bit more than just we are here, but what I would recommend that you put would be we are here, and this is where we are studying ancient history. Okay,
I'm just sort of explaining it, my own idea.
I understand, and so that idea is good, but there's a better answer. Okay, that's my point. All right, let's go to, let's see, I think it's pretty much the same in upper L, except upper L also has 2 and 3. So guys in the upper L, you can tell me your number one answers as well, but go ahead and tell me number two, please, upper L team. Rosetta.
The founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, giving birth to the United States of America.
Okay, there we go, right? And so, again, that's another way to explain we are here. Every single one of these facts is actually part of you, of we are here. Otherwise, they wouldn't be anchor facts. We are here in a world where we have a democracy, for instance, and we are here in a world that is America-centric. We are here in a world where the world is globalized. We are here in a world where Christianity is an important religion. We are here in a world where we know about our ancient past, and so on. All of that's a part of our world, and that's what the anchor facts are there to show us. Okay, 1492, please. Not a hard one. Number three, Sigourney.
The discovery of America by Christopher Columbus.
Okay, straightforward enough. Just the fact itself, right? And thus, we are here connected to the ancient history that happened in Europe and Asia. Okay, so that would be a little bit more of a present-centric connection, right? A way of saying it just, that event happened, and that's how we, over here, number one, became connected to the ancient world. Okay, good. Continuing on, let's go with the upper L crowd. Number four, circa 4 BC. Henry Wyatt.
Jesus is born, leading to Christianity as the most important religion in the world.
Okay, there we go. So that's good. You got the fact and you have the significance, which is really good. Okay, so number five on the upper L is the same as number two on the lower L. So anybody can answer that one. Circa 776 BC. Opal, go ahead.
The first Olympics were held in ancient Greece, uniting all of the city-states.
Okay, right. As us, I would say we got to be a little bit careful of that, the way that you put it, Opal. You got the basic idea, but the Olympics, I would not say. It's a little tricky little point, but pay attention here. I would not say that the Olympics unified Greece. Okay, that would be causation. Can you think of perhaps another way of putting it that would be a little bit more correct? In a way, you've got the causation reversed. It's not Olympics, then unity. Go ahead, Opal.
It was Greece was unified to have the Olympics.
That's it. Excellent. Okay. All right, you got my point. Good. Good. So in order to have an Olympic Games, you had to have a people that were unified, that would want to have this religious and athletic festival in common. And so they would say, well, we're all Greeks. Hey, so let's have a common festival. It wasn't as much, let's have a common festival to unite ourselves. Although, you know, just to acknowledge the possibility, there's a certain regard in which you could say the festival itself would help to unify people. And that's kind of part of what some, you know, people in modern times have also felt, that if we can just set aside our differences and enjoy the festival, that it would help as a cause to unify people. Now, whether or not that works is an interesting question. It's more, I would say, it's more of an effect than it is a cause. But it's a good one to think about in that regard. Okay, let's talk about what on the upper L is number 6 and what on the lower L is number 3. 1922 AD. Who's got that one? Henry or Wyatt?
This is Wyatt.
Mm-hmm.
The intact tomb of King Tut was discovered by a Howard Carter, leading to a new interest in archaic Egypt, modern society.
In modern society. Okay, very nice, right? Ancient Egypt gets to be exciting again because of Howard Carter and the discovery of the tomb. Okay, taking us into more archaic studies, let's do what is number 7 on upper L and what is number 4 on lower L. So who's got that? Circa 1700 BC. Patrick?
The Code of Hammurabi was written saying an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth.
Okay, good. The Code of Hammurabi says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Archaic law. Right? And as we learn, of course, it's not nearly as even as it sounds. It's really a way for an aristocracy to rule commoners. That's the way archaic life is. All right, let's go to number 8, circa 2500 BC, which is number 5 for the lower L. So, Sigourney?
The greatest pyramid ever built was for Pharaoh Khufu.
Okay, that's true in the sense that that is the single object, but nobody looks at that one pyramid by itself. So I think it's a little bit better idea to talk about the group of pyramids rather than the individual one. They were all constructed around this time, and we don't really have a need to worry so much about exactly what order it was and exactly whose pyramid was whose. That's just not that big of a deal for us in modern times. What is a big deal is that we have this group of huge pyramids. It's not a single pyramid. So we're a little bit better off saying that we have the group. So if we're going to do it that way, how should we name it? How should we write that down? Henry, Wyatt?
Oh, The pyramids of Giza are made in Egypt, creating a permanent symbol of pharaonic culture to inspire later civilization to the study of the history of ancient Egypt.
Okay, right. The pyramids of Giza would be the way that I would describe it, Sigourney. You're right, that, and there's nothing wrong with knowing the details, but it would be a mistake to say the details instead of the main idea. Okay, so it's fine to know which one was for Khufu, and which one was for Menkaure, and which one was for Khafre, and so on. And these are the names of the, and which ones were the queens, and so on. So it's fine to know that as a detail. Just like it's fine to know the details of, let's say, the translation of the Rosetta Stone. Right? We have the discovery, we have the translation, we have these different events that are connected to it. And so it's good to know the details, just like in any case it is, right? But we want to know the overall meaning, and the overall meaning is the, all of the pyramids in that grouping, which are so impressive together. Okay, let's go to Lower L and Upper L Part 2, now that we've done all the anchor facts. And let's start with the Upper L. Greece is a mountainous country and has no single great river valley. How did this affect Greek history? Sigourney, go ahead.
Greece is a mountainous and rugged land. It does not have a great river valley that provides a wonderful environment like Egypt or Mesopotamia. Even every Greek community was divided from the others, so the Greeks had to form into small separate countries called city-states rather than one unified country.
Okay, lovely. All right, that is a nice, elaborate answer. It's got everything in it. If it was taking up too much room, you didn't necessarily have to restate this at the very beginning. But that was a nice kind of paragraph length answer, Sigourney. So, and you certainly got there. So good job, right? The idea is it's not the same kind of wonderful environment as Egypt or Mesopotamia. That meant that the Greeks had to live in a lot of separate communities. And so their history is the history of city-states, not the history of one country. Okay, and so let's talk about the Lower L question that is related to that, which is, a Greek city was more like a country. What word do we use to describe this? What word did the Greeks use? Okay, so Patrick, or, well, Henry perhaps. Go ahead, Henry.
A Greek city was more like a country, so we call it a city-state. The Greeks called it a polis.
Okay, good. There we go. Greek city was more like a country, so we call it a city-state. The Greeks called that a polis. And the modern word, politics, comes from that. So, all right, let's continue now to the next section. Or actually, we have more in the upper row. What things did the people of Greece have in common, even though they lived in separate city-states? Okay, Rosetta, go ahead.
Things that people in Greece have in common were that all the people have the same language and all the people practice the same religion.
Okay, that's the main thing. And then we might include, as a result, something that they did, which we also had with an anchor fact. Right? Which was what?
The Olympics.
And then as a result, they went together and had the Olympic festival on a regular basis together. Yeah, something like that. I mean, you got the two crucial points, that they had their common religion and their common language, and as a result, they had a feeling of unity at which they celebrated through the Olympic Games. Okay, good. Anybody want their own answer on that one? Wyatt, perhaps?
The people of Greece all believed in the same gods and spoke the same language. They all put their city first and Greece after.
Oh, that's an interesting way of putting it, right? So that was something that they had in common, even though, of course, their separate cities were not in common. So, but your point is well put, that they were all mainly citizens of cities, not the country. That was something that, in a strange sort of way, it divided them, but they had it in common. All right, that perspective, shall we say. All right, so now let's go to, let me go to the lower elementary. What is an aristocracy? Who were the aristocrats of Athens? Patrick, please.
An aristocracy means the rule of the best. The Eupatrids were the aristocrats of Athens.
Okay, good. That's it. That's the key that we want. We want to know these terms. An aristocracy is the rule of the best. It might be a good idea to explain what that means, the best. Who is the best? Right? So we would say an aristocracy means the rule of the best, or a group of people that thinks of themselves as the best. Okay? And the Eupatrids were the ones in Athens who thought they were the best. So we could have a little bit of a longer answer. That is the basic answer that we need, but we could have a little bit more of an explanation maybe about what it means. Okay, let's go to the upper L. Who were the Eupatrids of Athens? So that, now, see, I'm not giving you guys in the upper L a choice. You got to explain it to me. How did they change the government of Athens in its early history? Opal, please.
The Eupatrids of Athens were sons of noble fathers. They changed Athens into an aristocracy. Aristocracy means rule of the best because they thought they were the best.
Okay, nicely done. So they were the sons of noble fathers that changed the government of Athens into an aristocracy, meaning the rule of the best. Okay, good. Anybody have a different formulation they want to try out? So Gurney says she can't hear. So what's going on there? Who can't you hear, Sigourney? If she can't hear me, then she won't even hear the question. All right, minor technical issue. Anybody else want to do their question to number 11? Okay, Wyatt?
The Eupatrids of Athens were the aristocrats of Athens. They turned Athens into an aristocracy by splitting the king's power between the people.
Okay, all right.
By reducing the archon's rule to one per year only.
Okay, all right. That's good. There's some nice details in there. So those, I think the details were kind of options, and you did a good job in including them, so I think that would be a good approach. Okay, give us a second over here. We're going to take a 30-second break, and Patrick and I will be right back.
Sometimes I feel like, I know you just let's
All right, team, we're back. All right, so let's get going here. Let's continue on with number 12. What was a Tyrannos? Who became the Tyrannos of Athens, and how did he succeed? Ah, we've had a good session of that recently, so you guys should be able to do that one. Go ahead, Sigourney.
A Tyrannos is a king chosen by the people for the people. Solon ended debt slavery, but he refused to redistribute property from the aristocrats to the commoners. But the commoners wanted more land after a while, and they wanted a Tyrannos, and they chose Pisistratus.
Okay.
Pisistratus made himself very popular by taking land from the aristocrats and giving it to the commoners. Oh. Aristocrats who resisted this authority were exiled.
Okay, all right. So that was a little bit long. Maybe the last sentence we didn't need there. Your answers are great, Sigourney. They have a lot of the different parts that you would like, but maybe a little bit more than is necessary. Okay, so be careful. Unless you've got really, really tiny writing, I don't see how you could fit that in that space. So remember to try to use the space as a guideline for how to, to choose the length of your answer. And so the part about Solon is all background story. Probably doesn't need to be there either, right? I mean, this is not a paragraph on the rise of Athens or Athenian democracy. It's a short answer about Pisistratus. So that's the thing to focus on. So be careful about putting a little bit too much information in your answer. Okay, but basically that was right. So let's look at the lower L version of that. A little bit different. What was a Tyrannos? Who tried but failed to become the Tyrannos of Athens? So, Patrick, go ahead.
A Tyrannos is a popular leader chosen by the commoners. Circa 632 BC, Cylon failed to become the Tyrannos of Athens.
Okay, Cylon was the one that failed, and then the upper L is about the Pisistratus is the one who succeeded. So you might expect that I'm going to flip those on you guys in your test. And the lower L will have to say who succeeded, and the upper L will have to say who failed. No, something like that. We'll see what I decide to do. Okay, let's move on here to number 9. In the upper L, who invented democracy? How were laws made in Athens under this form of government? Quiet, please.
Debt slavery is enslavement through debt. So on.
Wait! Slow down. Wait a minute. Okay, we got our wires crossed. I asked a lower L question, and then you answered an upper L question of the same number. So we got our wires crossed here. And so I wanted lower L, who invented, I guess maybe it was my confusion. Let's just take a breath. Okay. This is lower L. Number 9, who invented democracy? How were laws made in this form of government? So are you answering on Henry's behalf here? Are you ready to do that one, or you want to do the other one, Henry?
This is Henry.
Okay.
Cleisthenes invented democracy. Representatives from the deans voted to make laws in Athens. The majority ruled.
Nicely done. Okay, that's very succinct and just right. Cleisthenes invented it. Representatives of the deans voted, and the majority ruled. That's exactly what we needed there. Okay, well done. All right, so now let's go to upper L. Let's see. This is what you were trying to answer there, Wyatt. What was debt slavery? So I'm going to go ahead, Wyatt, and let you try to answer that one now. And what did Solon do about it?
Debt slavery is enslavement through debt. Solon emancipated the slave, then abolished debt slavery.
Okay, nice. You might have been tempted there to go on and tell the rest of the story, but it's better that you didn't, right? Because, again, this is not an extra paragraph where you have to say so much more. You just got to keep to the answers and fit it in there. So good job. All right, upper L still. What would have happened with the aristocracy back in power if Cleisthenes had not invented democracy? What was Pleistocene's basic idea for breaking the pattern of violence in Athens? Well, this is a good challenge question, so I want to hear everybody's version of it. So, Granny, get us started.
If Athens continues to have a lot of political violence, it would eventually break apart completely and it would be conquered by another city-state. Cleisthenes would then be able to convince the aristocracy to share power with the commoners.
Okay. And, yeah, so you got both parts there. It might be nice just, in this case, Sigourney, to add a little bit. In other words, to share the power with the commoners, thus creating democracy, right? To get that little last point in there, right? So the power sharing and the democracy go hand in hand. So we want those both there. Let's have some other versions of that answer. Rosetta.
There would have been a civil war between the aristocrats and the commoners if Cleisthenes had not invented democracy.
Oh, okay, you got that. You snuck that all into one sentence there. It might have been, in that case, it might have been nice to just break it up a little bit and spend time on each part, right? Because when you have two questions in the same, two-part question, it's kind of nice to treat the two questions separately and give two separate answers. What you did was you weave them together. And it works, but it's a little bit rushed. Okay, so now let's have Wyatt's version.
The aristocrats would have taken away the rights of the commoners, and the commoners would have rebelled again. Cleisthenes allowed the commoners to take part in the government.
Okay, so Wyatt, that's good. And the same thing applies to you as applies for Sigourney, meaning that then you could say, well, and thus share power with the aristocrats in what became the world's first democracy. If we just have that last little phrase there, it would just be the perfect ending to your answer. Now, I hope I'm not cutting you off like I did with Rosetta. I guess I was a little impatient, and I'm sorry about that, Rosetta. So please give us your answer again and go ahead and finish it, and I won't rush you.
There would have been a civil war between the aristocrats and the commoners if Cleisthenes had not invented democracy. Cleisthenes' basic idea for joining together the Athenian aristocrats and commoners was to make the aristocrats and commoners work together and make laws together.
Okay, there we go. And I think now I didn't stop you. So then the same thing applies with you there. And to give it that final touch would be to work together in a democracy. And then that answer would be perfect as well. Okay, all right. So you guys got the idea and the answers were all good. But there was just that last little touch remaining that didn't quite get finished up. All right, let's go to the much less happy Spartans. What age did Spartan children stay at home? What did they do after that? This is a lower L question, number 10. Okay, Patrick, would you please answer that?
Okay. Spartan children stayed home until they were 7 years old. Then the government takes them to a public school to become physical warriors. There was a period in between, but I just sort of rushed myself a little bit.
No, I heard it correctly. Okay, right, to become warriors. The one thing, I just have a small comment about that. You have to be careful about, and this is true in your writing as well. If you start the answer in the past, then you should keep your answer in the past. So, if Spartan children stayed home, then the government did what? You said, then the government takes. But that's now in the present. So if they stayed home, what would we say? The government
would take?
Well, okay, would take would be another simple past, would be took, right, rather than takes. Just a grammatical point there. Henry, please.
Spartan boys stayed at home until they were 7. After that, they were trained to be in the military by the government. They lived a public school. Spartan girls were also trained by the government. They were trained to manage the land of their families.
Okay, right. Oh, yeah. So you included the boys and the girls there. Yeah. So I put children when I really should have just said boys, because that was obviously the key, was the age 7 part, and that didn't change for the girls. But I'd probably give you a bonus point for your thoughtful answer there. Okay, so let's see. Upperel, we got to get you guys done here. Okay, archaic Sparta. What was one way Sparta was like an aristocracy? Why is that not the best term to use for Sparta's form of government? Ooh, good interpretive question. All right, Rosetta, go ahead.
Sparta was like an aristocracy. Was that there was a separation between powers of officials. An aristocracy is not the best term to use for Sparta's form of government, because Sparta had several different elements to its government.
Oh, okay. All right. This is a good answer. That's the whole answer?
Yes.
Okay. So, a couple things. You said that the powers were divided. Yeah, that's a good answer. So that would be a component, and I'm expecting kind of different answers here. So I would probably just mark that right. That's one of the answers. There's a separation of powers. Although you might be a little bit more specific, you could say there was a separation of powers that otherwise would have belonged to a king. So this is what made it an aristocracy instead of a monarchy or duarchy. But then, as you said, there were other elements of different forms of government. And then especially the fact that the aristos, had zero rights themselves. This is why it should be called communism. Okay, so that's the key there, is not merely the different kinds of things, which there are, and that's good. But especially the fact that it's not an aristocracy in the sense that if you are a member of this club, this the best group, you don't get anything special or good beyond having to live your whole life for the state. So basically, you are a slave. That's just a different definition of slave. So the aristocrats themselves were slaves to the government. Just a collective form of slavery. Henry, Wyatt.
Do you want me to answer the question too?
Sure, sure.
Sparta was like an aristocracy because the king's power was split up between 5 officials named ephors. This is not a good name for it because as each stage of a Spartan and citizen was controlled by the government from birth.
Okay, all right, that's on the right track. Couple little comments. One is that the power of the kings was divided among 2 kings and 5 ephors. So don't just put it as 5 ephors. If you're going to go to that, if you're going to discuss that point, you should say 2 kings and 5 ephors. That would be the best way to explain the mix of power that you would normally find in one kingship. Okay, and that's not the best term to use because the life of a Spartan belonged to the government. And thus he was as much a slave as the other slaves. Okay, so that would be perhaps a shorter version of the same thing. Patrick, on your number 11, please, for the lower L, give us this. What is the name of the form of government where every individual must live for the state, please?
The name of the government where individuals must live for the state is communism.
Okay, good. There we go. So that's the essence of it, is that there's nobody with rights in Sparta. Everybody is under the control of the government. Even the people who are, they're part of the government, but they're also stuck. They are completely stuck in their lives. Okay, let's finish up for the Super L has got another question. Number 16. There were really only two jobs in Sparta. What were they? Why did the Spartans organize their society this way? Why did the Spartans live like this? Wyatt.
The only two jobs in Sparta were, one, a warrior, two, managing the land of their families. And they arranged their government like this because they thought life was war.
There you go. All right, exactly. They thought that the crucial thing about life is war. You don't get walls and a city unless you can defend them. There is no civilization without the ability to fight war. War is the key. So, they're all warriors and managers of land. Those are the only things that need to get done if you're going to be able to fight wars, supposedly. Turns out they were wrong about that, but there were some pretty fascinating things that they accomplished anyway. All right. It's pretty amazing because the truth is, which is hard, nobody could have known that back then, but the truth is, and Athens proved this to some extent, but the United States is the greatest proof of all. The truth is that if you want to be the best at fighting wars, you have to embrace freedom. It's actually the opposite of what the Spartans thought. And they say, the proof is in the pudding. The United States is the most powerful country in the history of mankind. Well, guess what? It's the freest. So wait a minute, Sparta, you were wrong. You had a basic idea there that to be good at fighting wars, that's what you got to spend all your time doing. It's actually not true. Pretty neat. Okay, let's go to the bonus, which is the same for everybody, just different numbers. What is the word for something that lasts 10 years, like the kingship in Athens? Sigourney.
Decennial.
All right. Okay. The one word is decennial. Kingship is the is how it applies to that. Okay. What was the name of the fighting unit involving heavily armed soldiers that made commoners more important? Rosetta.
Phalanx.
The phalanx. Okay. And then number 19 or lower L 14. What Greek lawmaker made especially harsh laws? Opal.
Draco.
And nowadays we say, did anybody get away with anything at home lately by saying that the measures, their punishments of their parents were draconian? If you didn't, you've missed an opportunity, right? Mr. Powell says that you get a lighter punishment if you know that a harsh punishment is referred to as draconian. Okay, so good job, everybody. Good discussion, good answers. Everything went really nicely there. So the tests themselves will be posted with the recording of today's class, and you've got the whole weekend and more, depending on how you guys organize things in your house, to do that test. So good luck with that. It occurs to me that we are not back until Tuesday. Am I right? I believe it is Martin Luther King Day on Monday. Yes, 18th. The 18th is a day off. So you got an extra day to do your test. All right. So looking forward to talking with you again on Tuesday the 19th, everybody. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mr.